everywhere.
I warned you, we're going to come right back, and we have it. This is the Taylor Report. I'm Phil Taylor. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and I told you before, I'll tell you again, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can listen to this program and previous programs at facebook.com/the Taylor Report, and we hope you will do that. We expect to be speaking shortly to Fred Jerome, and I'll just tell you again, it's based on the film Trumbo, which is getting a lot of, as it should, a lot of attention. So this is a matter that needs to be kind of explored. Because something special happened in that film. Instead of having Trumbo be a liberal and a misunderstood liberal, or one who has become a rabid anti-communist or whatever necessary features in Hollywood to get you on the screen, Mr. Trumbo is represented as exactly what he was at the time that he was writing novels and became known to the world. He was a member of the Communist Party, and in the film he talks about that. We're joined now by Fred Jerome himself. Are you there, Fred?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much. We're talking about this film Trumbo, and we're talking about McCarthyism, and you would know quite a bit about that. Your father was one of those who came under the hammer of the, I guess, the Truman-inspired move to eliminate the Communist Party of USA and to make life difficult for anybody contradicting the sort of the Cold War policies of America.
Well, he was actually one of more than 100 Communist Party officials who were arrested during that period, and very few people know that, but I know it because couldn't avoid it, and he was convicted under the Smith Act and sentenced to 3 years in federal prison, and which he served in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, in the federal penitentiary.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, by the way, this is culture, and particularly Hollywood, right the center of talking about America. You could hardly talk about one without the other. And in the case of your father, like Trumbo, they decided in the Smith Act prosecution that he was guilty of an overt act, and he had written a pamphlet called Grasp the Weapon of Culture.
Correct.
That's pretty provocative. We're scaring our listeners right now. Grasp, most people would say.
Since the actual charge that they were all charged with, the Communist Party officials, was conspiring to teach and advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence. Mm-hmm. So the word weapon, I suppose, they used this article, pamphlet, because it had the word weapon in it.
Mm-hmm. I figured that's good enough.
Yeah. But if you read the, if anybody interested, I actually have a copy of it, and he talks about the fact that the government is using culture around the world that was at that time and still is sending movies and TV programs and so on to sort of promote it. This country, the U.S., as the answer to all of the world's problems.
Well, now, I'm remembering now, even as you say that they did form something called the Freedom and Culture Organization. Sidney Hook and others formed it.
Yes. And that actually was earlier, that's right. That was, in the 30s or 40s, but in the 50s they were still going strong, and they still are.
Well, they were breaking up meetings. Actually, there was a peace conference where Soviet artists were invited. The great composer Shostakovich, I think, was invited. Two Canadian intellectuals at University of Toronto professors were ordered out of the country because they tried to attend that.
Right. Actually, Einstein was involved in that meeting. It was after World War II in the 40s, and I think they wouldn't let the Soviets attend that conference either. That was the U.S. Government.
If you believe in cultural freedom, you got to make sure that people like they don't show up, right?
Right.
And not allowed to speak, and not allowed to write. And who are they living with right now? Yes, very important.
In any case, go ahead.
Well, I want to make sure I get you to the all film reviewers always want to know, what do you think of the movie?
Well, briefly, if I can. I don't know if that's possible for me, but anyways.
Go ahead.
First, the good news, or the positive, I think that it was one of the, it was very well done first, and it was one of the very few films really to give us a glimpse of the that period in U.S. history, which we call McCarthyism or the Great Red Scare, and usually people think of the 50s, the 1950s, but actually it began almost immediately after World War II, 45 or 46. Remember, Churchill gave this Iron Curtain speech, I think that was 1946, talking about Russians putting an Iron Curtain across Europe. And anyway, so the very few films have talked about that period, and there are very few, if any, courses taught, college courses taught about McCarthyism. I actually taught one at the New School for a while, a number of years ago, before they cut back a lot of their courses. But I think that would be a much-needed thing. So this film gives us a glimpse of it. And Trumbo is also one of the very few films where the hero or any of the sort of positive characters says, I'm a communist, identifies himself as a communist with some pride. I mean, he refuses to answer the congressional committee, the congressional investigating committee's questions. But then there's that wonderful scene with Trumbo and his daughter, where she asks him, to me it's the highlight of the film, where she says, she asks him, are you a communist? And he says, yes. And then she says, is Mama a communist? He says, no. And then she says, am I a communist? Well, you have to see it, but it's a great scene, and he actually, in the course of answering the question, there's even an explanation of what a communist is, or at least the beginning of an explanation. It talks about the importance of believing and sharing the wealth. And so it's a start. But having said that, let me say some offer some more critical comments. Basically, I think the film suffers from two big misses that almost all Hollywood films on history suffer from. And the first is that it almost Hollywood history is almost always one man against the world. It could be one woman, but it's almost always one man against the world. And you never really see whom they're apart, whom they're with. And I think Trumbo would have been the first to say this, that this is not a story about one man, not a story about Trumbo. And yet you don't see the others, the thousands of others who protested around the world. And in fact, there was a Gallup poll done at the time, I think the 2-1 against indicting the Hollywood people, of thousands of people that they questioned. And you don't see the Hollywood supporters, there were many, and you don't really even see the Hollywood Ten. I mean, there's reference to the fact that he was one of the Hollywood Ten, but there were nine others indicted with him. Actually, there were originally supposed to be the Hollywood 11, because Brex was supposed to be indicted also.
By the way, isn't there a lovely picture that you see of Trumbo and his wife? It's somebody took, and sitting behind him, rarely mentioned, is Bertolt Brecht.
Right, and he was there. He was there for the hearing, and he left the country right after the hearing, so they couldn't indict. I mean, he wasn't there to be indicted.
Yeah, he saw which way the wind was blowing.
Right. Anyway, so there were 10 Hollywood people indicted for contempt of Congress in November of 1947 for refusing to answer questions put to them by the committee. Based on, they refused to answer because of the First Amendment. And there's this wonderful quote from Trumbo, which isn't in the movie, but it could be, which he says, I'm definitely guilty of having contempt for Congress. And I don't think it's a crime, but I definitely had and still have contempt for Congress.
Yeah. By the way, there were some brilliant things said. Wasn't it Ring Lardner Jr. who wrote MASH, who said, I'd like to answer your question, but I'd feel bad about it in the morning.
Right, yes. So, in any case, that is one of the weaknesses. There's just one man against the world. And then the other weakness, really, which is related, is that they don't really explain why this was happening, why maybe it's beginning to happen again, or it's happening again now, but that's another question. But Gore Vidal wrote, wonderful quote in which he said, "The only question really worth asking is why." Mm-hmm. And they don't really tell you why they went after Trumbo. I mean, why this one man? Of course, that's related to the fact that it wasn't just this one man. In any case, some years ago, I mean, they don't really tell you why this was happening in 1946, 47.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the beginning of the Cold War. I remember some years ago I interviewed the great mathematician Dirk Stroik in his home outside of Boston. He was 102 years old at the time.
Wow.
But completely lucid and much sharper than most, including yours truly. He had been called before the committee and refused to answer questions about his politics. At the time, he was a professor at MIT. And when he refused to answer the questions, they suspended him. There was so much protest over that, and so many people came to his defense that MIT had to continue paying him. So he was suspended with pay, which was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was the result of the protest that he was... In any case, I asked him whether he thought there would be another McCarthy period. So this was 20 years ago, mm-hmm. or 15 years ago. And he said, if they need it, they will create it. And he said they needed it in 1945 because the American public was, at that time, still very sympathetic, friendly with the Soviets. They had just sort of beaten the Nazis together, mm-hmm. or at least they were allies, the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And there was a great deal of sympathy for the Soviets among the American public, and they needed to, when they decided to start the Cold War again, as they being the U.S. and U.K. and Western powers, they needed to do something about this attitude that people had of friendship for the Russians. So you have to, first of all, I suppose one could say, well, why did they decide to start the Cold War again? And I think the answer would be, in a word, socialism. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean the Bernie Sanders type of socialism, although even that seems to scare some of the Washington folks quite a bit, but this was
socialism. It's opened a few eyes, yes.
But this was socialism that had seized the land and property and state power in the largest country in the world,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to be spreading. So, it was certainly something that they needed the Cold War. They needed to change the public opinion to turn the public against the Soviets to support the Cold War.
Yes,
Just
apropos of that, I saw in your book the I think it was the Einstein file a picture of Albert Einstein with Henry Wallace and I think Paul Robeson.
Yes, yes.
And that gives you an idea, you know, that the people in Washington and elsewhere in the U.S. who had a lot of power, they weren't too happy to see that.
No, and clearly,
not the road they wanted to take.
It was a time that Einstein said reminded him of Germany. I just want to see if I can uh-huh. quote him exactly. He says, "In Germany, I saw how excessive nationalism can spread like a disease, bringing tragedy to millions. And now I recognize indications of the disease also in this country, in the U.S. And basically, that is why he supported Henry Wallace and the Progressive Party, is because they were against the Cold War. They were for establishing a friendship with the Soviet Union, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And so that was Einstein. I have to say that when the Hollywood 10 were subpoenaed, John Howard Lawson had, in his testimony, said much the same thing. And it was infuriating to the congressional people, but he said you're using the old technique, which mm-hmm. was used in Hitler Germany,
mm-hmm.
to create a scare here, to create an entirely false atmosphere in which, you know, this hearing was conducted. And it goes on and on. I won't read the whole thing, but mm-hmm. the idea is that a frightened population can be manipulated, and if you create enough of a scare, as they were trying, as they did, in fact.
Yes, one gets a sense of that now, right? I mean, you get that.
Yes.
You live through it. People are afraid to talk about a lot of subjects, and certainly if you're a Muslim in America, you've got to assume that they're all over you. I mean,
if you can't
get on a plane, you can't, have public meetings without being worried.
And I think the other thing is people just don't realize how much that is happening here. I mean, I was reading a piece in the Times, in the New York Times, about a week and a half ago. I don't have it in front of me now, but it says, in 2002, the number of names on the no-fly list that the U.S. government has, so they, check that when you go get on a plane, if your name is on the list, you can't fly. The number of names on the no-fly list was 16. That's 1/6.
Mm-hmm.
And today, or 2015, there were over 40,000 names on that list.
Yes. Yes.
what kind of a government apparatus do you need to check all those names and enforce all those names and keep it going and add to it and so on?
Yes. In Canada, we just recently had a case where a 10-year-old child turned out to be on the list.
Yeah. Well.
And they say, we'd like to take it off, but it's awfully hard.
Right. Exactly.
Say, well, how about you go to jail while you think that over?
Yeah.
We're not supposed to say such things. By the way, I want to mention, this is Fred Jerome. He had a great book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism. It's a, which you can find, just Fred Jerome. And Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover, his secret war against the world's most famous scientist, Albert Einstein. There's a great article by Fred Jerome. All you do is write the name Fred Jerome and then Count Bernadotte, and up will come a terrific article about those who murdered the United Nations representative, Count Bernadotte, and says so much to tell you about the development of the State of Israel. Brilliant article. Now, Fred, I got to make sure we mention a sense. One of the things that I got out of the film, and also I've now read a lot about Trumbo, more about him, and it's so laughable in that Trumbo is a very human guy. They asked him, why did you join the Communist Party? He said, well, they were bright, interesting people. We all got along. He said, why not? In other words, he wasn't a big ideologue. And some people are trying to almost use that to get him out of there. They said, well, he wasn't really. Well, actually, that's his story.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a rat. If somebody attacked his friend, he defended him.
Right.
Now, of course, you met some of these people. I think you met John Howard Lawson, perhaps.
Yes, definitely.
They came to your home. Can you give us an idea of Paul Robes and John Howard Lawson? Who are these, what are these people like as people?
Well, actually, I really think in many ways the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, except for meeting my wife, and was having met on many occasions Paul Robes, and he came to our house. This was during the 1950s, during the blacklist period. There were many, many artists who couldn't make films, couldn't get Broadway, do anything on Broadway. And so there was a kind of an organization of left artists that attempted to set up theaters and plays, did actually set up some in small places in New York. But and my parents, since my father had the assignment of being responsible for culture for the Communist Party, they would have gatherings in their apartment. There was a 4-story walk up, but it was big enough to hold a lot of people. And at least once a month, of artists who were blacklisted who would come together, and somebody would read a scene from a play, or somebody would sing, or somebody would recite poetry. And these were many of the blacklisted artists. I remember Paul Robeson was there on many occasions, and Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee and Frank Silvera, Theodore Ward, who was a playwright, and more, many more. And this was the probably of all the people there that I met that I remember, Paul Robeson was the one who held it all together and who brought people together. I mean, they knew the people came because they knew that my parents were communists, and this was part of their commitment to be friends with the communists, to reach out, not to go along with the anti-communist hysteria of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was Robeson probably more than anybody else who held everybody together.
Yeah. And by the way, Fred Jerome wrote Einstein on race and racism, and it takes up talks a great deal about his relationship to Paul Robeson. And just if we could, at the last story, you wrote an op-ed piece once about the relationship Robeson, Einstein, et cetera, and for the New York Times, and they chose to eliminate Robeson's name. Could you tell us quickly that story?
Yeah. Well, this goes back quite a number of years. I'm trying to remember the exact year, but in any case, let's see, it was 19... No, I'm sorry.
Well, take your word for it.
All right. Anyway, 1998,
uh-huh.
And it was about Einstein, and it was another reason for it. But in the course of the article, I wrote that he had many friends that most people don't know about, and one of them was Paul Robeson. And the next day, when I picked up the Times and of course, looked right away for my article and was very happy to see it there. I read it, and Paul Robeson's name wasn't in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that they never do in the Times. I think the Times has a rule that they're not allowed to edit your op-ed piece without discussing it with you.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they did it, rule or no rule. And that night, the editor who was responsible for that article happened to be speaking at a bookstore near my house, and I went over there, and I asked him, why did you take Paul Robeson's name out of my article? And without missing a beat, without hesitating, he said, well, it was just too explosive.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's right. Exactly.
Illustrates everything we need to do.
Right.
Fred Jerome, thank you for the great books, and I thank you very much for this discussion. I think we learned a lot of it. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Well, maybe that's not the right word. But anyway.
The next time they make a film like Trumbo, we'll call you again. It might be
okay.
A while.
Okay. Great. Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to The Taylor Report. And it's CIUT. You could write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and go to find us, facebook.com/The Taylor Report. And thank you very much. We'll see you next week.